Bitco is revolutionizing the way businesses connect. We're taking on your connectivity challenges and shooting our high-speed fiber internet across the country. Not just for some, but for everyone. Fiber is not a luxury, but a necessity. For business, for life, for you. And being connected is everything. So network with a Tier 1 internet provider and take your business to the next level of connectivity. Bitco.co.za. Connectivity is everything.
Running a business keeps you on your toes. Wouldn't it be great if your internet connection could keep up? Introducing Business Class Fiber from Vox. It's super fast, reliable, and highly cost-effective. You get unlimited calls to all SA destinations, and it's scalable. So no matter the size of your business, you've still got room to grow. Get connected with Business Class Fiber from Vox and see what super fast internet really means. For more information, visit vox.co.za.
Thank you for listening to the Tech Central podcast. I'm Duncan MacLeod. I'm on a call to Cape Town today to talk to Andy Bax, Chief Operating Officer of Seaborn Networks. Regular listeners to the show will remember we spoke a few months back to Seaborn CEO Larry Schwartz. Given how quickly these projects tend to move, though, I've got no doubt there's been quite a bit of update in that time. So, Andy, welcome to the show, and thanks for sharing the latest news of the Seaborn subsea fiber project to connect South Africa with Brazil and the U.S.
No, thanks for having me on.
It's a pleasure. First of all, before we talk about the project, tell me a bit about yourself, Andy. I believe you started your career in the Royal Air Force.
I've been in subsea cables now for over 20 years. So it's been a long and fruitful career, I suppose you'd say. I started off with the flag cable system, which was actually the first ever private cable, broke the mold in terms of private operating cables instead of traditional consortium cables. That one went from Europe to Japan, was 15 different landings. Moved on from there and then built and brought into service all the global crossings submarine cable systems. Spent some time on the supply side with Global Marine, which was a cable ship company that Larry and I were involved in for a few years. And then we started with Seaborn. So I guess if you total all those up, it's, I think with Seabrass 1, which was the cable that we brought into service last year, put me just over 250,000 kilometers of cable under the sea.
That's a lot of broadband.
Enough to go around the world. Yeah, that's a lot of broadband. It's a lot of glass.
So, Andy, you're down in Cape Town this week. What's brought you down to the Mother City? Is there an event happening down there that you're attending?
There is. So, you know, part of being a responsible cable operator in the subsea space is getting involved with several different organizations, one of which is International Cable Protection Committee, which is it's like a self-regulatory body across the entire subsea cable industry. So it's operators, network providers, marine installers, the whole spectrum of people involved in what we do to provide these cables under the sea. And this really is a body that gets together and amongst other things, makes sure that when we interact with one another on the bottom of the ocean, we do so in a sensible manner, in a reasonable manner. We respect other cable systems, and we make sure that, you know, as we add to the ever-growing list of cables under the sea, we don't interrupt what's already there. So it's always a good body to be part of. We're always happy to be involved in stuff like this. And it just, you know, moves the industry forward in terms of new technologies and new things that we can do just to make these cables, you know, even more secure than they are today.
Now, Seaborn Networks announced plans, I think it was back in November of 2017, to build a cable system to connect South Africa with Brazil and onward to the US, while interconnecting with another new system called the IOX cable, which will run from South Africa to India, connecting various Indian Ocean islands along its route. Andy, what's happened since that announcement was made?
So we've been busy. We're well into the development phase now as far as the cable system from what we call Sabre, which is from South Africa to Brazil. Development's ongoing with that. We've done a lot of work in terms of, you know, technical requirements, but also spent an awful lot of time talking to constituents that would be interested in being on such a cable as that. So, you know, not just people in South Africa, not just people even in the region, but as you just mentioned, folks like IOX, where, you know, onward connectivity from that cable into, you know, other parts of the region and beyond. So, you know, as you said, India, rest of Asia, East Coast and West Coast of Africa, and even up into, you know, as far as up into the Middle East, where, you know, having not a instead of route, but an additional route that is more secure, more direct, and provides resilience to the region in terms of connectivity to the States, as opposed to, you know, the single routes today that exist going through the Middle East and specifically Egypt and all the challenges that brings. So we spent a great deal of time talking to constituents, really explaining fundamentally what the difference is in the model that we're taking with this particular cable. Normally, you know, cables that you see built around as, you know, standalone infrastructure. So the goal is to, you know, generate as much revenues and return on that as you can. We're taking a slightly different approach with Sabre. The intention here is to effectively drive traffic on a different path from the region to the U.S., a more direct path, less active elements, therefore much more operationally stable, and generate traffic on the system that we've already built, Seabrass 1. So the intention with this cable, and it's a model, it's a business model that it takes a little while for folks that are used to even consortiums but private cables in the region today. The intention is that based on how much capacity you may want on this cable, you will pay a proportional cost of what it takes to build it. There's no market price. There's no markup. There's no, you know, it's this much per 10 gig or 100 gig or a terabit. We estimate the cable is going to cost somewhere between, you know, when all said and done, including cable stations, access terrestrial networks to the POPs and the data centers, we estimate it's somewhere around about $120 to $140 million, which, you know, it's a decent-sized infrastructure project. It's not a huge amount of money for a cable of this length, but there's plenty of capacity on it. There's an awful lot of capacity on it for what exists today. And the intention is that effectively for us, we treat this like a very long, wet piece of backhaul network that connects to Seabrass 1. So depending how much capacity a carrier or an operator or a large ISP or, you know, somebody that's carried across the IOX network from the rest of the region, depending how much they want, based on how much capacity the total cable will carry, they will pay a proportional cost of the build to get them from Cape Town to Brazil. And then they'll get a better than market rate, very, very competitive price to get them from Brazil to the US. So total cost of ownership in terms of getting people from, you know, the region to the US will be dramatically lower than it is today. One of the huge advantages that we believe that brings to the region is it enables operators, carriers, even the content providers, you know, the large hyperscale content providers, enables them to get out of the mode that a lot of them are in right now, where they basically buy when they need it, which is not the most, you know, satisfying way to plan your network long term if you're a service provider. What this means they can do is they can buy significantly more capacity, not necessarily activate all of it right now, but basically put a stake in the ground that says we have enough for the next, you know, call it whatever you want, 10, 15 years. We have enough capacity on this cable to get us to the US, to get us to Brazil, for the next 10 to 15 years. Now we can plan our growth properly. We're not restricted. market forces won't drive how much we can grow. And that's really what this is all about, enabling growth in the region.
Okay. So all the traffic that comes out of South Africa at the moment, or certainly all the subsea traffic that comes out of South Africa, either travels along the East Coast or the West Coast, then typically up into Europe and across to the US. So what you're doing here is building a much shorter route to the States, which will have an impact on speed and latency on the network, which I suppose is very important for some applications. What is the exact route that this cable is going to take? Where will the landing stations be located specifically?
So we've not identified exactly where the station will be right now. There's a couple of existing cable stations that are either already housed what are now retired cables, or housed today what will soon be retired cables. And in the past, you know, electronics being what it was, you can imagine 15, 20 years ago, the electronics used for these cable systems was monstrous compared to what it is today. So these cable stations that exist that have been around for 15, 20 years, perfectly good buildings, very well built, you know, very well protected in terms of power and cooling and everything you need from a carrier class environment. But there's huge amounts of space in them. They're just basically empty almost. Even if the cables that operate on them today are full, because equipment's got so much smaller, there's a vast amount of space. There's a vast amount of available power and cooling in those facilities. So, you know, what we try and do, and we did it very successfully on Seabrass 1 when we landed in the U.S., is take advantage of those scenarios, work out some, you know, commercially beneficial agreements for both parties in terms of who owns the station, and obviously for us wanting to be in the station, and leverage those buildings, you know, to keep using them, maintain them, and keep using them into the future. So there's existing landings down there that we could use. There's a landing corridor for existing cables that land, you know, in and around Cape Town. It doesn't mean that we won't go through all the standard environmental and permit and processes. We won't go through all the normal licensing processes, but we'll do all those just like we did in the US and Brazil, and we'll do them all properly. But yeah, we've got landings identified there. We have got a landing identified in the northern region of Brazil. It won't be the traditional landing point in Brazil. I don't know if you're aware, but today in the north of Brazil, almost all the cables land in Fortaleza.
Yes.
And that's historical. That's for no commercial reason. It's not for financial reasons. It's historical, technical reasons. At the time that cables started being built from the U.S. down to South America, that was as far as you could go. So they picked the closest point they could, which happened to be Fortaleza. So today, there's a large ecosystem of submarine cables in Fortaleza, a large concentration, and just as you look elsewhere around the world, there's a single point of failure, you know, potentially in that particular landing location. So we've picked a spot that is a little further south, a place called Recife. It is not only diverse from Fortaleza in terms of landing, it's a little bit shorter in terms of a crossing across to Cape Town. It also happens to be a very highly technologically focused commercial area. There's a huge amount of tech-focused service industry there. Hundreds of companies, tens of thousands of employees, all based in and around Recife, but no international cable there today. So we're not only going to connect Seabrass 1 into that part of Brazil, we're also going to connect Cape Town into that part of Brazil. So effectively create, you know, connections between like-minded environments in terms of technology focus, commercial attraction, and bring those communities together by taking that approach. But it will, as you mentioned, it will be a significantly shorter route than going up the West Coast or the East, all the way through Europe and then across the Atlantic. Estimates are we will reduce latency by, you know, not quite a third, maybe 25%, which is a dramatic reduction in latency. Not just for the financial community, but also for, you know, content providers, CDN companies, gaming companies especially. You know, any reduction in latency for all of those industries is a huge attraction. And of course, it's only going to be, you know, we like to talk about it in terms of comparing it to an airline. We will have from Cape Town to New York a one-stop route. If you look at existing routes today, there's dozens of stops to get you there. And what that effectively means is there's dozens of places where things can go wrong.
Yeah.
We just have one stop.
Yeah, yeah. Now, you're going to be the first cable along this route. The I know there's another cable project to run a cable between Angola and Brazil, but you're going to be the first cable between Cape Town and Brazil. So you'll be putting this cable on a seabed that where there hasn't been a cable system previously. Are you expecting any specific challenges of deploying along this route? Are there any undersea mountain ranges, volcanoes, or anything like that you need to be aware of in this project?
So we don't envisage, I mean, you're right, this is a route that has not been built before. We don't envisage any dramatic challenges, nothing different to any other part of the world. Anywhere, to be honest, anywhere where you lay a transoceanic cable that is, you know, at least a couple of thousand kilometers long, you're going to come across mountains and hills and ranges that, you know, look just like they do on the surface, except they're thousands of meters below the ocean. We'll do exactly what we did on Seabrass 1 and what I've done on the thousands of kilometers that we've done before. There'll be a very detailed marine route survey that gets done first, mm-hmm. that will give us an extremely accurate view of not just the ups and downs of the river, mountains, hills, valleys, but also, you know, what kind of terrain's down there. Is it sandy? Is it rocky? We need to avoid anything that's rocky, because over time that can cause abrasions and damage the cable. So that'll all be done as part and parcel of what we like to call it an industry standard submarine cable deployment. And then that's half the reason these things take so long.
Yeah.
The planning is probably 70% of the actual work itself.
I was going to say there's an enormous amount of project management involved in these cables. In fact, most of the work you do is project management related, right?
It is. Yeah, it is. And it's a piece that we at Seabourn, we take very, very seriously. I mean, we will have, you know, throughout the entire process, as the cables being manufactured in the factory, as the undersea amplifiers are being manufactured and tested, we actually have people in the factory alongside the manufacturer, witnessing the testing, watching all the samples, watching all the test results come off, and watching the different amplifiers and repeaters and, in some cases, branching units coming off the production line. Not an approach that is generally taken in the industry, but one we take very, very carefully, including, you know, there's a seaborne rep that's on the vessel, mm-hmm. when it's installing the cable. You know, if there are buildings being built and manholes being put in beaches and conduits being dug in streets, we're right there every single step of the way, making sure that A, it's to the quality that we need, that it complies with what we've been able to achieve and pull, that it's, you know, it's compliant with whatever regulations the local authorities want, so that at the end of the day, when we're finished, everybody is happy and satisfied that this is the right cable system that we said we'd build up front.
Okay. Have you contracted a party to do the marine survey for you at this stage?
So we have not contracted yet for the marine route survey. We've spent a lot of time talking to the different turnkey installers for submarine cable systems. What tends to happen is you will pick a, just as you do for, you know, a major real estate developer, you'll pick a company provider for the cable and the amplifiers, but they have the ships that install it and they have the power equipment that powers it. And as part of that, they also either have or they contract the marine route survey company that goes out and does the marine route survey. So right now we are, you know, we're probably more than halfway through our development phase. We think we'll be done with the development cycle by somewhere around the back end of this year. Mm-hmm. We'd look to, around the turn of the year, you know, start kicking the project off in terms of things like site surveys, nailing down exactly where landings are going to be in terms of where the beach landing will be, and then kicking off the marine route survey on the back of identifying those places. And then it's probably, for a cable this type, and in the environmental permitting environment we're in on both ends of the cable, it's probably an 18-month build to complete it. As with most of these cables, the actual building of it could be a lot quicker than that. But you have to follow the right environmental process and the right procedures and go through the right ticks and the right boxes with the right agencies and do it all the right way. So we will definitely be doing that. So it's about 18 months to build.
Okay. So when are we likely to, when is it likely to be ready for service? Sometime in 2020?
We're looking at somewhere around about the first half of 2020. Okay. Probably towards the middle of 2020, you know, as a realistic target.
Hmm. Okay. Now, there's a lot of talk in the market about open access versus consortium models and all the different models that, you know, various submarine cable builds have gone through. Is this going to be an open access network at all? And if it is, what exactly does that mean?
So there's various technical connotations for open access. Seaborne, I guess at a very simplistic level, Seaborne is we're an independent owner-operator of these cable systems. We don't have, you know, we're not PTTs. We don't have a huge domestic network. We don't have enterprise or retail customers or content. We don't even hold content for anybody. We are just what we like to call the bridge between two cities.
Mm-hmm.
As an independent player, we at a very simple commercial level, we are totally open. We will sell wholesale capacity to anybody that wants it on these cable systems. We're not restrictive. We don't treat any one party different from another, especially in the model like this one where it's proportional cost. If you're buying the same amount of capacity as a huge OTT or a huge carrier in the region, and maybe you're not a very well-known name, you're paying exactly the same as them and getting exactly the same commercial deal that they do. Mm. And you get looked after by us just as well as they do as well, because this is all we do. But then on a technical level, open cable systems, the intention there is for large purchases of capacity, as in, you know, terabits, is to enable them to use what equipment they want to use when they want to use it. So they can access their whatever capacity they've reserved on the cable, they can access it at the cable station or at the POP an unflavored delivery mechanism. So they can put any equipment on the end they want to. They're not restricted by whichever turnkey provider put the submarine cable in. They're not restricted by whoever we pick.
Mm-hmm.
If they want to put a completely different box, as long as it's, you know, certified and approved for use on international networks, and as long as it will technically do what they want it to do, they can put whatever they want on the end. And that won't interrupt with anything that we or other customers are doing. And just as importantly, whatever technology we use won't interrupt with what they're doing either. So the networks we're deploying now, so for example, we announced recently we're building from Brazil to Argentina system. Customers on that system that buy, you know, sufficient amounts of capacity for it to make sense for them can put whatever equipment and technology they like on the end. And in the future, they can change it, they can move it, they can do whatever they like. And Sabre will be exactly the same.
Okay. Have you decided yet how many fiber pairs are going to be in this cable system and what the ultimate design capacity of it will be?
We have. So present time, our plan right now is that Sabre will be a 2-fiber pair cable, which doesn't sound very much. We estimate that we should be able to get somewhere in the region of 20 terabits of fiber pair onto that cable system. So, you know, theoretically 40 terabits coming out of South Africa is an awful lot of capacity for the foreseeable future.
Mm.
And as you mentioned earlier, it's on a route. Effectively, that would be a direct route between Cape Town and the U.S., which doesn't exist today. And one of the challenges that we looked at very early on when we started this process was, you know, if you're building transatlantic from New York to London, you can look at all kinds of data and models and historical information that tells you this is how much traffic there is, this is how much it grows every year, this is when the next cable is needed because demand is growing at X percent per year. When you look at a route that doesn't exist today, you can't do that. Mm-hmm. So it really wouldn't make sense to build an 8-fiber pair cable or even a 4-fiber pair cable. Just as it doesn't really make sense to try and build a cable all the way from Cape Town to the U.S., to New York, because that is significantly more expensive, as a result, significantly more risky. So we feel that, you know, this build that we're doing in conjunction with Seabrass One is a very sensible approach. It's not a small cable, you know, 30 to 40 terabits is by no means small. But if in the next, you know, if 5 or 6 years after it's built, it actually proves out that the route is growing as much as we think and we hope it will be, then maybe then there's an argument for a direct cable between the two continents. Who knows?
Mm. Are you expecting?
But we think this is the right approach.
Sorry, Andy, are you expecting to take significant traffic from existing cable routes that go via Europe at the moment? Do you think there's going to be demand from the internet service providers who are currently taking traffic along the West Coast, for example, and across the North Atlantic to go direct on this route and therefore to switch their business?
We don't think we don't think it's a replacement cable. Because it is, you know, it's more direct. It is faster from Cape Town. You know, if you look at on a pure like-for-like basis, Cape Town to New York versus, you know, going through Europe versus this, it's a lot quicker. But what we like to think about it is it's an additional route. Mm-hmm. You know, more and more today, especially the hyperscalers and the content providers, they look for multiple different routes between different endpoints, such that they can scale and manage their traffic, you know, in a fault-tolerant method. If a route goes down, they want to be on at least two or three other routes going between the same two places. So carriers take the same approach. All the content and hyper, you know, the if you like, the tier two content and OTTs, they're taking exactly the same approach. We don't think it's a replacement. We think it's a very good additional route.
All right. And if you don't mind, maybe just talk us through your association with the IOX cable. Is there any cross shareholding there? And do you intend to connect directly to IOX, which I know is going to be landing in East London, whereas I think you are looking at the Cape Town area?
Yeah, so that's actually a model that we're taking. We've done this approach with IOX. We've also taken this approach with several other, if you like, independent, you know, cable owners that are similar to what we do, not exactly the same, but similar kind of approach to how we take to building cables. So there's no shareholding there. There's no cross-pollination of equity or ownership. It is what we call the joint provisioning agreement between ourselves and IOX. And the intent really is to give both operators basically end-to-end access to the combined network. So obviously it brings huge advantages to IOX because it means that they can basically not only sell but also deliver across the combined networks of IOX, Sabre, and Seabrass. So, you know, up and down Brazil and also to the US. And it also brings huge advantages for us too because it means we can do exactly the same. We can reach beyond Cape Town and into those, you know, into those extension networks, and throughout the networks that IOX is deploying right now. So we think it's an interesting model. It's an exciting model. It's one that we've deployed on the other end of Seabrass One up in New York with some other cable systems. And we're already seeing the fruits of that relationship up there. So, you know, as these cables get finished and they get built out, there will need to be, as you mentioned, there'll need to be, you know, small supplemental networks developed to enable those direct connections, but we think it's a very cost-effective and efficient way to enable, you know, parties across both regions to utilize the combined networks that we're delivering.
So do you see yourself interconnecting with IOX via terrestrial fiber, or is there likely to be a spur, subsea spur around the Cape of Good Hope to connect to East London?
So it's a discussion we're having with them right now. There's discussions around both, the pros and cons of both. Obviously, from an implementation perspective, there's challenges to both approaches. But we're discussing the options around, we could do it terrestrially today. Now, obviously, Sabre's not built today, and IOX is still building out their networks, but, there is terrestrial connectivity today. It could be enhanced if we wanted to take that approach. Alternatively, there are several other parties in the region that we're talking to that would also be interested in seeing a subsea route that went on around the bottom to connect those two places. So it might be more of a combined approach down the road that provides that connection.
Okay. Andy, I know we are out of time, but let me sneak in one final question. Why should South African internet users, the ordinary consumer, be excited about this cable system? What is it likely to do, if anything, to the cost of internet access in South Africa?
Well, I think one, and I kind of touched on it a little bit earlier on, one major advantage to this is providing capacity at a dramatically reduced cost. We saw when we built Seabrass 1 down into Brazil, US to Brazil was one of the most expensive cable routes in the world. Hugely, compared to other similar routes between other similarly sized economies, it was, multiples in terms of what it cost for very basic capacity and services like, access to IP, access to the internet for small to medium sized ISPs was actually, it would reduce their ability to grow. It would reduce their ability to not only grow their business, but also as, 4G and 5G come along and more, whether it's, fixed wireless internet or fixed wireline internet to premises, both residential and business, that usage goes, dramatically higher as more people start to use all these services and those broadband networks develop further into the region. But if the ISPs that service those customers can't afford to keep scaling their bandwidth higher and higher on the international side, all that happens is that the everyday users find that, yes, they have, their mobile phone tells them they're using LTE or 4G or 5G, but they're still getting 3G speeds because they're all getting congested by the ISPs because the ISPs can't afford to buy more and more bandwidth. I mentioned earlier on, we think this approach that we take where it's, proportional cost for capacity on Sabre, we think that right-sizes, what we like to call right-sizes, the price of international capacity into the region. Other cables like IOX coming in, like the other transatlantic cables that are being built further up the coast, they all help to right-size the region in terms of cost of access. Mm-hmm. And cost of access is, when we talk about cost of access, it's cost of access for those small, medium, and even large ISPs to purchase the volume of capacity they need to satisfy the growth that they should be seeing in their business. And that's where everyday, people in South Africa should be getting excited about the fact that they're getting a new cable because it should drive down the cost of capacity.
Excellent. Andy, I'm going to be watching developments of Seaborne Networks and the Sabre cable system with a great deal of interest. Andy Bax is Chief Operating Officer of Seaborne Networks. Thank you so much for talking to Tech Central today.